the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Tuesday, May 19, 2020. I'm your reader, Dan Shear. The top headline this morning, County Officials Want More Testing, by Amy Rivers of the Courier, Waterloo. The Cedar Valley may be seeing its numbers of new coronavirus cases and deaths flatten, but absent a vaccine, local officials warned against letting up on hygiene and social distancing measures. Blackhawk County had 12 new coronavirus cases Monday, for a total of 1,843 cases, and one new death for a total of 32 deaths, said Dr. Nafisa Cisse Ibonye, director of the Blackhawk County Health Department. The county has an infection rate of 1.4%, the sixth highest rate in the state, but just a 1.7% fatality rate, lower than Iowa's fatality rate of 2.4%. I know that people are ready to get back to their normal routines, and with some businesses reopening, it's very exciting, Ibonye said. But it's very important that we do not forget our preventative practices. The Blackhawk County chapter of the NAACP called the decision by Governor Kim Reynolds to reopen businesses in the county irresponsible. We are disturbed that this decision was made in light of surging cases, the executive committee said in a statement Saturday. To reopen the state of Iowa poses a greater threat to the overburdening of our health care systems and increases the potential for widespread infection and loss of life. Some business owners agreed, including Akeisha Hill, whose Bouget Berries shop in downtown Waterloo would remain open only for pre-orders and deliveries. She cited her small storefront as one reason. It's really important that everyone stay safe, she said Monday. We want to do everything we can to assist with that. Angie Fuller said her Farrell's Extreme Body Shaping was limiting exercise classes to 10 participants per the state's guidelines, and members uncomfortable with that could watch classes live online. We know the current restrictions may be changed in a few weeks, or they could last for months, Fuller said, noting her team had plans ready to go for those scenarios. Katie Bajerke, who owns Hatchlings and Hens Gift Shop in downtown Cedar Falls, says she's learned how to pivot to an online-only shop and has reopened her retail storefront with limited hours. She said she's spoken with other small business owners, quote, exhausted by the upheavals. It will take time for us to regain our stamina, she said. Some of us may never be able to return to what we were before all of this. A total of 130 people have been hospitalized in the county so far with COVID-19 for a hospitalization rate of 7%. Another 1,072 have recovered, said Ibonye. She added, the county has tested 7,074 residents so far for a positive test rate of 26%, much higher than the state's positive test rate of 14.5%. as well as the World Health Organization's recommended 10% or lower positive test rate for getting a handle on the virus. Ibonye said she'd like to see that number lowered, but to do that, the state would need to open up testing criteria to test many more people in the county. Right now, only certain categories of individuals qualified for testing. We do know that there are people that carry the virus, but are asymptomatic, she said. Unless we have mass testing, it's really hard to define the impact of COVID-19 on the overall county. Officials have tested all staff and residents of the county's four long-term care facility outbreaks, finding 85 cases at Harmony House, 40 cases at Friendship Village, 13 cases at New Aldea Lifescapes, and 5 cases at Pillar of Cedar Valley. The health department was monitoring an additional 2 long-term care facilities for outbreak potential, though it wouldn't name them. There were 12 such facilities in the county, and officials said they were offering tests to any staff or residents of those facilities. Western Home Communities, Ravenhood Specialty Care, and Pinnacle Specialty Care have all announced either employees or residents testing positive in recent weeks, but none of those facilities had yet been classified as having an outbreak. An additional 21 Blackhawk County residents who were tested had inconclusive results, Ibonye said. Per the Iowa Department of Public Health, testing was being opened up to children in daycare centers, including home-based daycare, as well as staff of those centers, Ibonye said. They had to have fever or respiratory symptoms and no other diagnosis, she said. The recommendation for travelers to self-isolate for 14 days was being dropped because the virus was already widely circulating in this area, Ebonier said. Next article, headlined Pandemic Guide for Kids. Parents and teachers in need of answers to teens' questions about the economic impact of the coronavirus pandemic will find answers in a new guide. Quote, Making Sense, Understanding the Financial Impact of COVID-19, unquote. Junior Achievement of Eastern Iowa has released the free resource that was written with middle school and high school students in mind. This is a tool that can help parents shed light on what's happening to the economy with specific financial content that answers questions like, what does a supply chain look like? What does the economy look like going through a pandemic? Why are some people losing their jobs? We've been working with Junior Achievement offices nationally and the headquarters in Colorado Springs to really focus content on financial literacy and what is relevant at this particular time, said Caitlin Tungland, J.A. of Eastern Iowa Senior District Manager. The guide uses relatable examples to explain what a recession is, how the Federal Reserve works and steps being taken by the government and private sector to deal with the economic impact associated with COVID-19. Junior Achievement is a national organization that provides young people with knowledge and skills to succeed and make smart academic and economic choices. Our mission has three pillars: work readiness, entrepreneurship, and financial literacy, Tungland explained. We partner with many school districts in eastern Iowa to fill gaps in their curriculum, and financial literacy is very relevant. JAEI's programs are delivered by 1,397 local volunteers who provide students with real-world examples of how obstacles can be overcome and success achieved. Obviously, with this pandemic, teachers, parents, and students have had to pivot quickly from the classroom to virtual learning and finding educational content. We have free online resources for teachers and parents who have students finishing their semester online, Tungland said. JAEI provides its programs to 47,665 students throughout eastern Iowa, which includes Benton, Blackhawk, Bremer, Buchanan, Delaware, Grundy, Iowa, Johnson, Jones, and Linn counties. Butler, Cerro Gordo, Chickasaw, Fayette, Floyd, Franklin, Tama, and Winnesheek counties participate through distance learning. Tungland is hopeful that Iowa's school districts will open to start a new school year this fall. Usually around August, we touch base with school districts and superintendents to determine what JA programs they want, and we typically start our classes in September and October. Hopefully that timeline will still be relevant, but until then, we're going with the flow like everybody else, she said. The downloadable guide, titled Making Sense, Understanding the Financial Impact of COVID-19, is available at ja.org/makingsense. Online JA educational resources are available at www.jaeasterniowa.org/. There's a highlighted box titled JAEI Virtual Fundraiser. Junior Achievement of Eastern Iowa is hosting a virtual Taste of Achievement silent auction now through Thursday. A live Facebook auction will take place from 6 to 7 p.m. Friday. For more information, go to https://secure.qgiv.com/event/JAEI Taste 2020/. Our next article is headlined Meet Cedar Falls Police Chief Candidates by Andrew Wind of the Courier from Cedar Falls. The three candidates for police chief will participate in a remote meet and greet that will first be broadcast Friday on Channel 15. Sponsored by the city and led by Mayor Rob Green, the event will feature introduction to each candidate and include a public question and answer segment intended to help the community learn more about the Cedar Falls police chief candidates. It's being done remotely to protect residents from the spread of COVID-19. It will include background information regarding the candidate's qualifications that the public can also view online at cedarfalls.com/CFPoliceChief. That is the location of an online submission form for candidate questions as well. Residents are able to submit questions until 10 a.m. Wednesday. A news release from the city notes that not all questions may be asked during the broadcast. The candidates, whose names were previously announced, include two current members of the Cedar Falls Public Safety Department, Acting Police Chief Craig Burt and Captain Mark Howard, Lieutenant Derek Turner of the Port of Portland, Oregon Police Department is also a candidate. Turner has a bachelor's degree in criminal justice from Ferris State University in Grand Rapids, Michigan. He was a sergeant with the Kalamazoo, Michigan Public Safety Department from 2007 to 2018, a police officer with the Flint Police Department from 2015 to 2016, and has been part of the Port of Portland since 2018. Burt has a bachelor's degree in criminology from the University of Northern Iowa. He also completed the Police Executive Leadership Graduate Program at the Southern Police Institute in Louisville, Kentucky. Burt has worked for the Cedar Falls Department since 1991 in various positions, including police officer, sergeant, lieutenant, and captain. He has been the assistant director / assistant police chief since 2016. He also served in the Army / Army National Guard from 1986 to 2012 and was a command sergeant major. Howard has a master's degree in public policy from UNI. He also graduated from the School of Police Staff and Command at the Northwestern University Center for Public Safety in Evanston, Illinois. Howard has worked for the Cedar Falls Department since 2007 as a police officer, lieutenant, and now captain. Prior to that, he was an officer with the Waverly Police Department from 1997 to 2007. The public will be able to view the meet-and-greet broadcast online via the Channel 15 YouTube channel at bit.ly/ch15cf. Or tune in to Channel 15 at various times, Friday, May 22 through Sunday, May 31. The list of times, none of which are the same from day to day, is too long to try to read here. Check Channel 15 for the schedule. Our next article, headlined Council OKs Firefighter Grant Application, by Jeff Reinitz of the Courier from Waterloo. Despite concerns over what damage the COVID-19 pandemic could do to the future of city coffers, City Council members on Monday voted to apply for a federal grant that could add firefighters to the city's department. The decision to try out for the Staffing for Adequate Fire and Emergency Response, anagrammed SAFER, grant came after the Federal Emergency Management Agency did away with a requirement that cities pick up part of the tab. Council member Margaret Klein cast the lone no vote, questioning if the move would mean city workers in other departments would be displaced if the coronavirus led to a lag in city revenue while the city was locked into fire services staffing levels because of the grant. This COVID-19 has just completely wrecked city budgets all across the nation, and we're going to find ourselves in a position of struggling to maintain just what we have, Klein said. I don't know why we would even consider setting ourselves up for such a situation. Council member Sharon Juan, who ultimately voted in favor, expressed similar concerns early in the debate. Council member Dave Bozen, a retired firefighter, said the city would be foolish not to try out for the funds, which would pay for 4 firefighters for 3 years. The federal government is offering 100% for these firefighters for 3 years, at basically no cost to the city, Bozen said. When you can get 4 firefighters to bring our staffing levels up to where they should be for zero cost to the city, I think it's crazy not to look into it. Originally, the SAFER grant required a 25% city match for 2 years, with 65% in the third year. Fire Chief Pat Treloar said his department had been concerned about committing to the grant because of what the pandemic may do to its budget. but the department decided to try out for it when the match requirement was dropped recently. Treloar said the grant writing was already completed, so there wouldn't be any additional cost to apply, and the city would decide to back out if they landed the grant and later decided against proceeding because of its financial situation. Treloar said the city could be in default of the grant if the department was forced to reduce its staffing levels. The grant won't cover personal protective equipment and a physical screening for the new hires. Waterloo Fire Rescue currently has 106 sworn firefighters. And Jeff writes another item, headlined Police Continue Investigation of Homicide from Waterloo. Police continue to investigate a Friday night shooting that claimed the life of a Waterloo man. Terrell Bernard Flowers, 30, arrived at Unity Point Allen Hospital with a gunshot wound around 8:41 p.m. He was pronounced dead a short time later. Police said Flowers was shot at 323 Crescent Place and was taken to the hospital in a private vehicle. Detectives have recovered firearms in connection with the investigation, and ballistic tests on the weapon are pending. No one has been charged with Flowers' death. Cedar Falls Council approves future sale of $3.5 million in loan notes by Andrew Wind, the courier from Cedar Falls. The city will sell $3.5 million in general obligation capital loan notes to help fund a series of infrastructure expenses and equipment purchases. The City Council approved issuing $2.8 million worth of loan notes grouped into what were called essential corporate purpose costs. The remaining $700,000 to be issued is for general corporate purpose projects. Both were approved in 6-1 votes, with Councilmember Dave Sires dissenting. After receiving bids, the loan notes will be sold June 15th. Funds will be spent during fiscal year 2020, which is underway, and fiscal year 2021, which starts July 1st. The loan notes will be repaid with interest using property tax dollars. Since we're kind of in troubled times right now, it would be nice if we could cut some things out and be more conservative, Sires suggested, voicing his objection to the sales. Jennifer Roddenbeck, Cedar Falls Director of Finance and Business Operations, noted that city staff 2 weeks earlier had detailed anticipated revenue shortfalls with the council related to the coronavirus pandemic. They talked about a number of projects that needed to be pushed back or find other funding sources as a result. We purposely try to sell bonds every other year so we can keep our property taxes stable, so we don't have these peaks and valleys, she explained. In addition, she said interest rates may be low, making it a good time to sell the loan notes. Officials are projecting rates around 1.6% compared to about 2.8% in past years. Resident Jim Skane objected to the limited information on the list of projects included in the memo that was part of the council information package. Quote, it's not even clear what it's all used for, he said. It seems to me that there's a lot of money being appropriated for indistinct purposes. Several council members defended the process, noting that information is available from city staff and online. Items included in the lists are part of the city's capital improvements program approved earlier in the year and have come to the council previously for approval. Among the 14 projects on the $2.8 million list are $735,000 for the Cedar Heights Drive reconstruction, $130,000 for Center Street improvements, $290,000 for Green Hill Road and South Main Street intersection construction, and $90,000 for the West First Street reconstruction. There is $245,000 in sidewalk work on five separate projects and a $520,000 box culvert installation on Olive Street. Equipment replacement includes a $200,000 for a fire truck, $40,000 for fire division bunker gear, and $40,000 for network camera installation and maintenance. Four projects are part of the $700,000 list. These include $165,000 for a South Main Street trail parking lot, $40,000 for trail infrastructure oversizing, $120,000 for annual street repair program amenities, and $273,000 for Phase 2 construction of the Union Road Trail. Later in the meeting, the council unanimously approved a $300,000 surface transportation block grant agreement with the Iowa Department of Transportation and the Union Road Trail Project, which has an estimated cost of $550,000. The 10-foot-wide recreation trail will run between 12th and 27th Street. Before the vote, Sires said a city engineer had, quote, threatened to locate the trail on the edge of or through the middle of property he owns along Union Road. Mayor Rob Green and Councilmember Nick Tabor came to the staff member's defense and called Sires' comments inappropriate. Sires noted he is, quote, for the trail and voted to approve the agreement. Here's a couple of public safety roundup notes. Headline: bribery attempt brings another charge in Waterloo. A Waterloo woman who was arrested following a Sunday disturbance allegedly kicked a police officer. She then allegedly offered him cash to let her go. The offer netted an additional charge, and Melody Kenosha McCollum, 29, was arrested for bribery in addition to assault on a police officer. Interference, public intoxication, and providing false identification information. Officers were called to a home in the 200 block of Randall Street around 1:30 a.m. Sunday and found McCollum yelling at people in the house. When police tried to detain her, she kicked one officer in the leg, according to court records. Once inside the squad car, she asked the officer to turn off his camera and told him she would pay him $1,200 to release her, records state. When they arrived at the Blackhawk County Jail, she allegedly used a false name and date of birth during the booking process. And a large fight is investigated in Waterloo. Police are investigating a large fight that broke out outside a Broadway Street store over the weekend. Police were called to Prime Mart, 508 Broadway Street, around 10:45 p.m. Saturday. No serious injuries were reported. A 4-minute video of the incident posted on social media shows dozens of people in the parking lot with numerous struggles breaking out and ends with someone shouting, "Police! Police! Police!" The video can be viewed on the Courier's website, wcfcourier.com. This is a reminder. You're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Tuesday, May 19th, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. In the Metro Deaths column from Cedar Falls, Barbara E. Furch, 1943 to 2020. Barbara Ellen Furch, 76, of Cedar Falls, died Saturday, May 16, at Unity Point Health Allen Hospital in Waterloo. She was born September 8, 1943, in Mattoon, Illinois, daughter of Raymond and Naomi Boaz Ely. She left high school to sell magazines while traveling across the United States, and as a result of this job, she met Robert Henriksen. They were married June 22, 1962, but later divorced. Barb was a bartender and worked at many area bars: Flips and Elmer's in Dyke, the Cypress Lounge, Blackhawk Lounge, and Stinger's. She married Larry Furch on April 27, 1994. Survivors include two sons, William with Lisa Henriksen and Brian Henriksen, both of Cedar Falls, 5 grandchildren, 6 great-grandchildren, 4 sisters, June with Franklin Stevenson, Mona with Jack Bates, Rose with Gary Swank, and Veronica with Larry Rosedesil, 2 brothers, Charles with Darlene Ely, and Jerry with Linda Ely. She was preceded in death by her parents, her husband Larry Furch, and 3 sisters, Naomi Kay, Faye Holliday, and Edna Brossard. A private service will be held with burial in Cedar Valley Memorial Gardens of Cedar Falls. Memorials to the family. Online condolences at www.dollfuneralhome.com. Barb was a bundle of energy, and when she wasn't tending bar, she was cleaning the house or anything to keep busy. She learned to enjoy gambling alongside Larry. Most of all, Barb was a friend to all and a loving mother and grandmother to her family. In the Northeast Iowa Deaths column from Fredericksburg, Francis, known as Francie R. Crawford, 1951 to 2020. Francis, Francie Ruth Crawford, 69, of Fredericksburg, died Saturday, May 16, at St. Mary's Hospital in Rochester, Minnesota. She was born January 12, 1951, in Cudahy, Wisconsin, daughter of Charles and Barbara Burkett Vickers. She graduated from Maple Valley High School in 1969. She attended the University of Northern Iowa, obtaining her degree in elementary education. She married Steve Crawford on July 27, 1974, at Barclay United Presbyterian Church, rural Dunkerton. She worked at St. Joseph Hospital in New Hampton as community outreach and education coordinator for 22 years, before becoming volunteer coordinator at Iowa Hospice at St. Croix Hospice. She was a member of the PEO and active in American Cancer Society and Relay for Life. In 2004, she was selected to be the Iowa recipient of the organization's Profile in Courage Award and served as an ambassador for National Relay for Life in Washington, D.C. three times. Survivors include her husband, two daughters, Leslie with James Winder of Waterloo, and Laura with Jim Kapaska of Westminster, Colorado, six grandchildren and three sisters. Preceded in death by her parents, a granddaughter, and a niece. Private services will be Wednesday, May 20th at United Methodist Church, Fredericksburg, burial at New Barclay Cemetery in rural Dunkerton. Hugeback Johnson Funeral Home and Crematory of New Hampton is in charge of arrangements. Online condolences at hugebackfuneralhome.com. There are an infinite number of ways Francie will be remembered by her family and dear friends, who were like family and her communities, but maybe the best way to sum up her life is that she made the world a better place while she was here. From New Hampton, John C. Knutson, 1939 to 2020. James Charles Knutson, 81, of New Hampton, died Wednesday, May 13, at home. He was born March 11, 1939, in Chickasaw County, son of Theodore and Tina Nelson Knutson. He graduated from New Hampton High School in 1957. In 1962, he was drafted into the U.S. Army. John then began a farming career in Chickasaw County. He married Catherine Rosemary Mikes on February 12, 1966. She died in 2009. John operated the family's trucking business for more than 30 years, retiring in 2017. He was a member of Trinity Lutheran Church. Survivors include two daughters, Amanda Knutson and Emily Knutson Dust of Chicago, Illinois, a sister, Donna Jepson of Kimberly, Wisconsin, a granddaughter, Maya Knutson Nyack, and numerous nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his parents and seven siblings, Norma, Oriette, Theodora, Stanley, Lois, Colleen, and Shirley. John's greatest joy was talking to his two daughters each day and was always there to support them in their journeys. A death notice, Harold E. Brown from Dunkerton. Harold Eugene Brown, 84, of Dunkerton, died Sunday, May 17, at home following a lengthy illness. A private visitation will be today, May 19, at White Funeral Home, 1315 Main Street in Jessup, with a drive-by visitation for the public from 5 to 6 p.m. at the funeral home. Graveside services will be 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, May 20th at Fairview Cemetery, Dunkerton. A celebration of life will be at a later date. Memorials to the family. Online condolences at www.white-mounthope.com. Death notice, Eunice C. Stockdale from Applington. Eunice Catherine Stockdale, 90, of Applington, died Friday, May 15, at the Journey Senior Living of Ankeny from natural causes. A prayer service will be 10 a.m. Wednesday, May 20, at Applington Evangelical Presbyterian Church, with private family burial and Pleasant View Cemetery, both in Applington. Memorials to the family. Redmond Schwartz Funeral Chapel in Applington is in charge of arrangements. Online condolences at www.redmond-schwartz.com. And finally, a death notice, Anne Chris Livingston from Waterloo. Anne, known as Chris Livingston, 72, of Waterloo, died Sunday, May 17, at home. Arrangements are pending with Locke Funeral Home, 233-6138. Now we'll turn to the op-ed page in the editorial of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for May 19, 2020. Headline, Ugly Justice in Rural Georgia County. A male was reportedly jogging down the road in a residential neighborhood in Satilla Shores in southwestern Georgia. Curious about a home construction project, he ducked in, took a look, and left. He hadn't taken anything. But that didn't deter two men in a pickup truck from following him, self-styled vigilantes, father and son, supposedly searching for a suspect in a string of burglaries. Yet the last reported burglary in the neighborhood was 53 days earlier, when a 9mm pistol was taken from an unlocked truck outside their home. The father later told Glynn County Police they yelled, "Stop, stop, we want to talk to you," pulled up next to the jogger, and then the son exited with a shotgun. He said the jogger began to violently attack his son, and the two men then started fighting over the shotgun, at which point the son fired a shot, and then a second shot, killing the jogger. Their weapons were drawn, quote, in case the jogger was armed. He wasn't. The father told police they'd seen the jogger on surveillance videos committing break-ins. The police didn't ask for details. District Attorney Jackie Johnson blocked arrests. The father was a former police detective and an investigator in her office from 1995 to 2019, whose performance evaluation has never surpassed good. He flunked a required training course in 2006, so he couldn't make arrests. He didn't pass firearms courses. Johnson wrote that was a great embarrassment to me and him. Justice in that jurisdiction was appalling. The 122-member police department has faced at least 17 lawsuits. The police chief and three members of the department were arrested for interfering in an investigation into a disbanded narcotics task force. The chief was charged with violating his oath, criminal attempt to commit a felony, and influencing a witness. Then there was the low-speed chase of a recently divorced and depressed young mother in 2010. Her tires were blown out and her vehicle pinned between two squad cars and a utility pole. Two police officers fired 8 shots through her windshield, killing her. A grand jury didn't pursue charges. In a federal civil rights lawsuit, the judge deemed the shooting unnecessary, but didn't violate her civil rights. One of those officers later killed his estranged wife and her boyfriend and himself. The case involving the jogger was sent to George Barnhill, a prosecutor in neighboring Waycross. He found insufficient probable cause for an arrest because the father and son were legally carrying firearms under Georgia's open carry law and within their rights to pursue a, quote, burglary suspect. A private person may arrest an offender if the offense is committed in his presence or within his immediate knowledge, he wrote, although the jogger hadn't been engaged in a crime. If the jogger was perceived to have attacked the son, he added, the son was, quote, allowed to use deadly force to protect himself, unquote, under state law. Facts in this convoluted reasoning were irrelevant, as underscored by his letter to Georgia Attorney General Chris Carr, quote, the jogger's family are not strangers to the local criminal justice system. From best we can tell, his older brother has gone to prison in the past and is currently in the county jail without bond, awaiting new felony prosecution. It also appears a cousin has been prosecuted by D.A. Johnson's office. Unquote. The jogger, a former high school football star, once was convicted of shoplifting and bringing a gun to campus. Family attorney Lee Merritt responded, the reference to alleged contact from high school or shoplifting is absurd and has nothing to do with his murder. The jogger, Ahmad Arbery, 25, was black, the victim of the same type of vigilante justice that claimed the life in 2012 of Trayvon Martin, 17, also black. He was shot and killed by neighborhood watchdog George Zimmerman, who deemed Martin, quote, suspicious, after leaving the home of his father's fiancée in a Sanford, Florida gated community. He had done nothing wrong. Zimmerman was found not guilty. He later tried to sell his gun to the Smithsonian as a piece of American history. The Arbery killing was cavalierly dismissed in Georgia until the New York Times reported on it 10 weeks later, and a video of the incident subsequently emerged. State officials belatedly took over the case and quickly charged Gregory, 64, and Travis McMichael, 34, with murder and aggravated assault. The shooting and its handling reek of racial injustice. The only caveat is that Carolyn Small, the young mother killed while in her car, was white. About that incident, a Georgia Bureau of Investigation agent said, "This is the worst shooting I've ever investigated." Again, nothing was done. So it may very well be that injustice in Linn County, Georgia, is blind. This is the opinion of the editorial board of the Waterloo-Cedar Falls Courier for May 19, 2020. Editorial board includes David Adams, general manager, Nancy Newhoff, editor, and Douglas Hines, news editor. Here's a story from the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, headlined, "How to Quell the Quarantine 15. If you've gained weight during the COVID-19 pandemic, you aren't alone. The, quote, Quarantine 15, referring to weight gain some people have experienced since stay-at-home guidelines went into effect, is likely due to a disruption in daily routine and habits. People's habits have changed quite a bit since we're spending more time at home," said Donald Hensrud, medical director of Mayo Clinic's Healthy Living Program in Rochester, Minnesota. "And those changes in habits can lead to health and medical issues down the road." Hensrud shares his thoughts on the disruption of habits and how people can find new habits. Quote, "Now I want to make a point for some people. Getting enough food, getting enough calories, and maintaining weight may be an issue," Hensrud said. "Not unintentionally losing weight. But for many of us, our habits have changed," he said. "For example, people think about exercise right away, and they should," Hensrud said. "Fitness centers are closed. People may be doing less exercise and burning less calories through activity that way. What people don't think quite as much about, though, is low-level activity throughout the day. Even if we have a desk job, we have to walk at least to our car to get to work. We may walk throughout the day. We may walk to lunch. And so, for spending time at home, that low-level activity may be causing us to burn fewer overall calories," he said. "We may be consuming more calories. On the good side, we're eating out less at restaurants. Sometimes that can be high calorie. We still may be taking takeout at home. So there might be a little bit of a good thing there, a decrease in calories. However, many people are stocking up frozen foods and processed foods that have a long shelf life. Many times they're higher in calories and less healthy. On the flip side, for example, fruits and vegetables don't last as long, and we may be consuming less of them. There are a number of reasons why we might be at risk for weight gain through our habits that have changed, both in burning activity and consuming more calories," Hensrud said. Why weight gain matters. A few pounds short-term may not make a difference. It could be fluid. It might be just a little bit weight gain while we establish new routines. Obviously, the more weight we gain and the longer it's maintained, the more it affects our health, Hensrud said. For children, for example, it's been shown that children's weight tracks to some extent. If children establish those habits or lack of healthy habits when they're young and they gain weight, that might persist as they go into adolescence and adulthood. Similarly, with adults, as we maintain those habits, if we can establish a new routine, the longer this goes on, then we can arrest that weight gain and try and maintain a normal weight. It's more important for some people than others. For example, people who have diabetes or high blood pressure, just a modest amount of weight gain in some people, if they're sensitive to that, can increase their blood glucose and blood pressure, and they won't have as well a good control over these factors, over these conditions, Hensrud said. With all habits, it takes time to establish them, so everybody is getting accustomed to this new normal. I'd encourage people to establish those new healthy habits now. You have to be a little proactive about this, and that'll make it easier in the long term. Break out of your comfort zone, Hensrud said. Try and raise your culinary skills and do a little bit more cooking. It's an opportunity for that, too. So if we can embrace this, embrace our new normal, look for opportunities to establish new healthy routines. In a sidebar to go along with this article, they have included a couple of nutrition tips. A healthy diet keeps the immune system balanced and ready to fight against infection and viruses, according to Kim Woodford, a nutrition education advisor for Penn State Extension. Since the COVID-19 pandemic, people may be searching for ways to boost their health amid the dilemma of planning a family meal with limited pantry resources. Others may be wondering how to make their day-long snack options more nutritionally friendly. A colorful plate equals healthy meal. Proteins and antioxidants are key elements of a balanced diet, Woodford said. Protein is the building block of immune cells. Sources include beans, nuts, and meat, including fish and poultry. Make sure your meals have color. Deep, rich colors from fruits and vegetables contain micronutrients and antioxidants which your body needs for protection and recovery from illness. When you emphasize protein and colorful foods in your diet, chances are you will get plenty of micronutrients needed for proper immune function, like vitamins A, B6, E, and C, and zinc. And the more veggies you eat, the more you might start to enjoy them, Woodford said. Vitamin D is an important vitamin for immune function that is lacking in foods, and low levels can increase your susceptibility to infection. Select foods that are fortified with vitamin D, such as low-fat milk, cereals, and orange juice, she said. Spending time in sunlight will help your body produce vitamin D. Aim for at least 10 to 15 minutes, 3 or 4 times a week, Woodford suggests. Here are some snacking tips. A general rule of thumb is to eat snacks that are in the 100-calorie range. With each snack, drink water, low-fat milk, or a non-caloric beverage, which will help to fill you up. A few suggestions for 100-calorie snacks are 2 cups of air-popped popcorn, 1 3-inch apple, 1 cup of snack mix made with popcorn and whole grain cereal, 1 half cup sliced carrots and celery, a whole wheat pita bread with jam, a graham cracker with low-fat or non-fat yogurt. Let's call the courier. First question, what happened to American Idol? Answer, like many shows, Idol halted production during the pandemic. Shows resumed in late April, with performers singing remotely from their homes. Just Sam was chosen the 2020 winner in the May 17th final. Question, why hasn't KWWL's new meteorologist Anthony Baglioni been on lately? Answer, he recently announced in a Facebook post that he has accepted a meteorologist job with KCTI-WYDO in New Bern, North Carolina. Question, what is the date that the covered bridge on East 4th Street was built? Who was the mayor back then? Answer, the canopy on the 4th Street Bridge, Cedar River, opened in 1976. Leo Roof was Waterloo's mayor from 1974 to 1984. Question, who would I call to find out if the city council has the power to override the police chief decision in Waterloo? Answer, we previously answered this question, noting the appointment of a police chief requires the council's approval. The Waterloo City Council voted unanimously to approve Mayor Quentin Hart's choice of Joel Fitzgerald as police chief. Question, when will the theme park open by Lost Island Water Park? Answer, the Lost Island theme park is expected to open in the spring or summer of 2022. Question, when will Goodwill start taking donations again? Answer, the local Goodwills are still closed in Blackhawk County. No one knows for sure when that will change. But Goodwill Industries of Northeast Iowa has announced that the stores in Independence, Decorah, and Maquoketa are now open for both donations and shoppers, with shortened hours from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. Question: what is the update on the Decorah Eagles? Answer: according to the Raptor Resource Project, 3 eggs hatched this spring and appear to be doing well. Observers on May 4th reported the young ones are attempting to self-feed and practicing, quote, mantling, that is, hunching, crouching, or arching shoulders and spreading their wings over food to conceal it from the others. Question: has MeTV canceled Beverly Hillbillies? The local MeTV has the show on its weekend schedule at 5 and 5:30 a.m. If it's Buddy Ebsen you're longing to see, and you can get up even earlier, Barnaby Jones is airing at 3 a.m. on weekdays. Question: what is Richard Dean Anderson doing now? How old is he? Is he married? Answer: Anderson, who is 70, has never married. In recent years, he's been more active in environmental charity work than in acting. He recently posted on his website that he's sheltering in place in California right now. Question: in James Bond movies, what do MI6 and Spectre mean? Answer: MI6 refers to the Secret Intelligence Service, the Foreign Intelligence Service of the Government of the United Kingdom. The name MI6 dates back to World War II, when it stood for Military Intelligence Section 6. Spectre, which is Special Executive for Counterintelligence, Terrorism, Revenge, and Extortion, is a fictional global criminal and terrorist organization featured in the Bond novels and movies. MI6 is real. Spectre is fictional. Question: is there an egg shortage? Two stores I was in today had raised their prices. Answer: it's more like a surge in demand for eggs, according to industry experts. At-home baking has caused a surge in demand for baking staples like flour, sugar, and eggs. But if you're seeing an exorbitant rise in prices, you can report it as price gouging to the Iowa Attorney General's offices at iowaattorneygeneral.gov. Question: can the governor make it mandatory for people to wear masks when they grocery shop? Answer: probably. Governor Kim Reynolds was given broad authority to run the state government while the Iowa legislature had suspended its session, including any measures needed to slow the spread of coronavirus. Question: can you list the counties in Iowa that have had zero cases of COVID-19? Counties without a recorded confirmed case of coronavirus on May 1 were Adams, Emmett, Fremont, Ida, Lucas, Monroe, Palo Alto, and Ringgold, according to the Iowa Department of Public Health. Question: who is Teresa Greenfield? Who's she running against? Answer: Teresa Greenfield is one of 5 Democrats running in the June 2nd U.S. Senate primary to run against incumbent Republican U.S. Senator Joni Ernst in November. Question: I have family returning from Florida on Sunday. Do they need to be quarantined for 14 days? Answer: yes, according to health officials. Beyond that, they may qualify to be tested. Check with your health care provider or visit testiowa.com. Question: the governor asked people to sew up masks. What material works to keep the coronavirus out? Answer: most patterns are calling for tightly woven soft fabric, like cotton or nylon. Question: why don't store employees have to wear masks? Answer: it looks as if it's not required by the state now, probably because of ongoing shortages of masks. But plenty of stores are requiring it for employees, Hy-Vee and Walmart, for example. Calls are taken on a special courier phone line at 234-3566. Questions are answered by courier staff and staff at the Waterloo Public Library. That does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Tuesday, May 19, 2020. I'm your reader, Dan Shear. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening today.
This is Tom Hatton with an Irish short take from the book A Culinary History of Iowa, and the first article we're going to read from the book is entitled Exploring Iowa. Located in the heart of America, Iowa is the land between two rivers, a region of the Midwest distinguished by a surprisingly rich, diverse cultural and culinary history. Between the forests of the eastern United States and the grasslands of the Great Plains to the west, Iowa's gently rolling landscape extends westward from the Mississippi River, which forms the state's entire eastern border. The Missouri River forms the western border, making Iowa the only U.S. state with two parallel rivers defining its borders. Rivers were the early highways, bringing explorers, trappers, traders, and settlers to the Iowa prairie. Centuries before the Europeans arrived, however, various Native American tribes, including the Sac, Fox, Sioux, Iowa, Meskwaki, and others, lived, hunted, and farmed across the region. The meaning of the name Iowa depends on who you ask. Traditionally, it has been described as an Iowa word, meaning the beautiful land. Although others say that Iowa itself is the French spelling of Iuawa, a name meaning sleepy ones, a name given in jest to the Iowa tribe by the Dakota Sioux. Living off the land defined the food and farming traditions of the tribes like the Iowa, whose history is carefully recreated at Living History Farms in Urbandale. Iowa farmers raised corn, beans, melons, and squash. Women did the farming in the Iowa culture, while men were responsible for hunting and making tools. Iowa families were subsistence farmers, raising just enough for their family to survive throughout the year, and having a little put away in case of a bad year. The Iowa had separate summer, winter, and traveling lodges. Bark houses called nachachi kept the Iowa cool during hot summer months, while winter mat houses called chakiruta, made from layers of sewn cattail leaves, protected the Iowa from harsh winters and stayed around 50 degrees inside. While traveling on hunting expeditions, the Iowa lived in a chibothraji, or teepee, made from buffalo hides. Their villages also contained sweat lodges, food drying racks, cooking areas, work areas, hide scraping rocks, pottery pits, and gardens. At Living History Farms, historical interpreters at the 1700 Iowa farm discuss hunting, hide processing, fur trading, tool making, gardening, food processing, and the roles that Iowa men and women played in each. Interpreters used both recreated bone and stone tools and reproduced trade items to perform daily tasks. By the era of the 1700 Iowa farm depicted at Living History Farms, the first Europeans had seen the land that would become Iowa. Had history taken a different course centuries ago, Iowans might be known for their unique brand of French cuisine with a distinctly Midwestern flair. In the late 1600s, European explorers began paddling up and down the Mississippi River, passing along Iowa's eastern border. The first to visit Iowa were Frenchmen. Louis Joliet led a crew accompanied by Father Marquette, a Catholic priest. In 1673, the expedition arrived in the area that includes Pikes Peak State Park near the Iowa town of McGregor. It would be almost 150 years after Marquette and Joliet sailed along Iowa's eastern border before white settlers began moving inland to farm Iowa's incredibly rich topsoil. In the meantime, trappers and traders began exploring the rivers that fed into the mighty Mississippi. The French established some trading posts that would grow into Midwestern cities, including St. Paul, Minnesota, Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, and St. Louis, Missouri. In the 1780s, a young Frenchman named Julien Dubuque learned that there were rich deposits of lead ore on the west side of the Mississippi River near Prairie du Chien. Lead was valuable because it was used to make ammunition for guns and cannons. Dubuque lived among the Native Americans in the area and mined the ore. Dubuque set up lead mines near the location of the city that bears his name and lived in the area until he died in 1810. And that was an excerpt from A Culinary History of Iowa by Darcy Doherty, Mulsey, and other offbeat stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.